Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the Herb Podcast. Welcome to our show in episode 468, as we share the truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her head. It's all in her head. No, it's not. Yeah, this is going to be a very special show, one that I know is really going to hit you deeply. Before we begin, please know that this episode is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y. These are vitamins, minerals, and herbs rooted in nature. They have a special gift for women, the new award-winning Her Life Stages products, providing support for the menstrual years, including PMS, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause. It's an integrative, holistic approach to having a woman's back throughout her life journey. To learn more about Her Life Stages, run on over to your local health food store or check it out at solaray.com. And when you do, if you go to the online, use HER20 as your promo. You'll be glad you did. And here's a reminder to click on iTunes to rate and review the show once we're done, because the Her Podcast team just loves your feedback. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind,
her body,
her life. It's all about her.
How many times have you sat around ripping your collective hair out of your scalps when someone says it's all in your head? You want to slap someone. How about that little bitch slap just when it's necessary? Well, is it all in your head? No, it's not. And I have an expert to be able to explain why it's not. Dr. Elizabeth Comen has dedicated her medical career to helping save women's lives. She's an award-winning, sought-after clinician and physician scientist. She works as a medical oncologist, that's cancer treatment, with a specialty in breast cancer at Memorial Sloan Kettering Center. And she has written a book, and this book is absolutely amazing. It's called All in Your Head. Elizabeth, welcome to the Her Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Elizabeth, why did you write this book?
Well, lots of different motivations, but I have spent my medical career caring for women, countless thousands of women suffering from breast cancer. And prior to that, I developed a long-standing interest in the experience of illness, particularly for women, and how that relates to cultural, historical, societal, religious influences. And for me, in my care of patients and also becoming a mother and being a daughter and a wife, really hearing so many stories and experiencing myself just how often women's healthcare is undervalued, women are misdiagnosed, misunderstood. The time it takes for female-specific disorders to be diagnosed is egregiously long in many instances, and also painful stories of women just feeling shame about their bodies or blamed for their illness when it has nothing to do with anything that they could have controlled. And I felt very compelled to unpack this legacy in the doctor's office, both as a physician myself and what it feels like for patients.
And I noticed in the book, which is just wonderful, that you've kind of broken all of this up into parts, women's parts in particular, you know, from bones to muscles to skin to circulation, et cetera. Why'd you do that?
Well, it's interesting because when I was in medical school, when I thought about women's health, and much of the lay public and even the medical community still considers women's health the purview of gynecology, and maybe throwing a little breast in there and you've got bikini medicine and that's what encompasses women's health. But in my work and in my research, I really came to understand that women's health is head to toe different from men. We are not small men. And I wanted to have a walk through women's bodies by organ system, the same way we learn about bodies in medical school, but also the same systems that mirror the specialties that we know today, like cardiology or gastroenterology or neurology, and really show what is unique to women and how have we underserved them along the way.
What were you shocked by? What comes to mind immediately, because as I'm reading through each of these sections, you've got some eye-popping stories to tell.
I would say every page has something about women's medical lives and stories that I had no idea. I was heartbroken of some of the torturous treatments that women went through, not just too long ago, whether it was treating women's mental illness by removing all their teeth or organs. This was not that long ago in our medical history, or lobotomies for women who were expressing political views and we were severing aspects of their brain, to all the way through our medical history, how much women's sexual desire and libido became the topic of control in medicine. And every diagnosis from scoliosis to asthma to anything you could possibly imagine was in many instances by key stakeholders in women's medical health linked to something about their sexual function or lack thereof. And that was one of the many surprising things along the way.
So really, there's a thread throughout the book, and that is an issue of control. I think that that is a manifestation, a reflection of the sociocultural times, whether it was in the 1700s, the 1800s, and beyond. It kind of blows your mind. I mean, as I was reading, you know, this is not the first time I've come in contact with this kind of content. I'm just repeatedly reminded how insanely out of control women were. And that the fact that any of these women, these great icons who popped up throughout the centuries, got anything done in terms of making history in whatever they were doing, whether it was Georgia O'Keeffe painting her extraordinary work, Amelia Earhart getting up there and flying with the boys, and all the rest of it. You think about the pushback they must have had during that time back and forth. So as I read this, this goes a little bit deeper. I'm looking specifically at bones right now. In your chapter, there was a little note. It said, "Dear Beth, I have scoliosis and my doctor wants me to wear a brace. My friend said she just did exercises and went to a chiropractor, and now she's all better. But my parents say I have to do what the doctor says." And this was Ask Beth in the Los Angeles Times in 1990. Why did you write that?
Well, obviously there's a nuance there that we want to have doctors that we trust and that we rely on and whose opinions we can follow if we feel so comfortable. But the history of scoliosis was very complicated. If you go back in time, which is one of the things that I so enjoyed in trying to unpack where these diagnoses come from and our thoughts about women, there were even ideas that women masturbating was a cause of scoliosis. Again, not that far away, or that women were more primal and therefore hunched over, or that when they were educated and they had to sit at desks, that prolonged desk sitting is what caused their scoliosis. And carried through, yes, in 1990. The reason why I included that was you can feel in that discussion how much this girl, this woman, feels like she does not have agency over her body. She has to do what the doctor says. And sometimes we do, but in many instances, we were not allowing for dialogue between the doctor and patient so that the patient feels like they have buy-in, that they understand their condition, that they understand the rationale. And a brace may be appropriate for scoliosis, but there also needs to be attention to how this affects women's movement, their sense of self, their sense of psychology, as opposed to, well, this is just something that you have to do. I wanted to also comment on your point about the history of these amazing women. One of the greatest joys in writing this book was the chance to interview some trailblazers, including one of the oldest living graduates, female graduates of Harvard Medical School, Nanette Wegner, who was really transformative in showing how women's cardiovascular disease is definitely different than men, how we have very much ignored the number one killer of women, which is heart disease in American history, American medical history. I graduated Harvard Med School too, but I was in a class of greater than 50% women. There were so few women in her class. There were so few women physicians in the hospital. She also went down to the South, where there was still segregation in hospitals, and really stood up against the racism that she experienced. So between the misogyny and the racism, I thought to myself, my goodness, how did this woman accomplish so much? for me, even in my own medical career, it has not always been easy. And I have so much more support and resources and a sisterhood behind me. And yet even writing this book, I faced many challenges. So I so appreciate your comments to honor the women that have come before us and really encapsulate the idea that well-behaved women do not make history.
I just absolutely love that. You know, you make me remember when I was in my laboratory at the National Institutes of Health, I had the utter pleasure of meeting Bernadette Healy, who was the first woman to ever head up the National Institutes of Health. There were a lot of people using the B word when it came to her, which is, as she was very adamant about getting women included in research. It just absolutely boggles my mind that when I got there to the NIH, that it was men's breast cancer, not women's breast cancer, that was taking precedence in research. And of course, men's breast cancer is much more rare. And with women, it's a whole different ballgame. I was just absolutely blown away. But she was also the physician who noted that if you want a dime out of the National Institutes of Health for a research grant, you will include a woman, if it's obviously appropriate for that particular theme and topic. Right about the same time, the Office of Women's Research was established, and one of my dearest friends was the original director, Dr. Vivian Pinn, who was there for many years. And it was fascinating watching what was going on with that entire emergence, as suddenly we realized, as you said so beautifully, women are not little men. We're actually very complicated, and we need to be honored and respected for that at multiple levels, which is why the way you put your book together here really resonates with me. Clearly, as a physician, you know, I saw the skin, circulatory, and muscle, and the rest of it, and I said, yep, we've been here before, you know, the same kind of a template, and yet I love the way you did it. As someone who sits on the board of the American College of Sports Medicine, and all of my HER podcast listeners know I'm a nutcase about fitness, I immediately made a beeline to muscle, I believe it was chapter 3. There you start with a beautiful quote, which is, of course, who's the weakest of them all? I really learned some pretty interesting facts from this. Tell us about those women gladiators. Good Lord. And what happened with that?
Yes. Well, I also just wanted to pick up on something that you said about Bernadine Healy, which is there are some great quotes from her in the book as well, where one of my favorites from 1991 is when she said, heart disease is also a woman's disease, not just a man's disease in disguise, which I thought was so powerful. And I love that you picked up on her amazing work. With respect to exercise, and I'm a fitness junkie myself. What was interesting about female gladiators, because I was trying to figure out when we go back in time, what did we say throughout the years about women in any instance of showing athletic prowess? And I thought, I just come from a trip with my family to see the Colosseum, and I love the whole idea of gladiators. But initially there were female gladiators, but then there was a concern that in reading in the literature, that it was just too much of a spectacle and there was too much disrespect for women in that aspect overall, and they no longer were permitted to participate as gladiators. I think throughout history, what's really interesting to me in my research is just how much we have focused on women being aesthetically pleasing as small instead of strong. And that even some of the most famous athletes were a product of their time in terms of what they could advocate for in athletics. So I grew up knowing who Tenley Albright was. So she was a famous Harvard Medical School trained female physician who was also an Olympic figure skater. And when I went to read about, well, what did she say about athletes? Here's this powerful female physician who was also an Olympic athlete. And she said time and again that certain sports were not feminine, and that we needed to think about, essentially, we don't want women to look too unfeminine and engage in sports that give them too bulky muscles. And we wonder where this legacy is when I go to sign up at a Pilates class, that women are worried that somehow instead of being long and lean and feminine looking, that they're going to develop bulky muscles from lifting weight in any respect. And you and I both know how important strength training is for our overall fitness.
I'm just laughing about the whole thing about being feminine. I'm a senior Olympic triathlete. Honey, there's nothing feminine about. I mean, good Lord, you know, you're a little wet mess after the first, you know, leg of this thing. And then you're sweating your little behind off. And you had this whole thing on the bicycle, which is, you know, the next piece of the triathlon. And then the running, I mean, at the end of the whole thing, you look like something the cat dragged in. And it was just, women now glow with sweat and glow with dirt under their nails from a Tough Mudder or whatever back and forth, because it's a celebration of the extraordinary beauty as we see it, as we define it in our lives. I couldn't help but laugh my little behind off on all the quotes you had about, I think this dated back to 1895, the Guide to Women on Bikes. Don't refuse assistance up a hill. You know, if someone tried to help me up a hill, I'd give them a good slap, like, get out of my way. It was wonderful. And it really brought back such great memories. And I know that women out there today who are really teeing it up at the start line for marathons, triathlons, and more are just saying, oh, to heck with all that, man. I'm out there to rock and roll. So I thank you for the trip down memory lane with the bikes and the rest of it. Oh my gosh. What about women's strength? What about that whole thing?
Yeah. So, and I really honor what an athlete you are. My goodness, that's incredible. Well, I see, you know, day in and day out in my practice, taking care of breast cancer patients, that there are a lot of women that are just so focused on being thin, especially now with women taking weight loss medications to lose 5 pounds and to fit in a size 2 jean. And they're just not, they have no experience because weightlifting is intimidating. They've never done that at the gym. They're so used to extensive amounts of cardio. And we know that strength is essential for mobility, for flexibility, for durability, and for prevention of osteoporosis and maintaining the strength of our spine, which is so integral and the basis for our whole body, staying up straight, right? And I, as a lifelong athlete and dancer, I didn't even really learn how to properly strength train till the past couple years. And I just see so often women intimidated and afraid that they're not going to look the way that they want to look and don't really have a sense of how it contributes to their longevity.
Huh. Well, you know, at the end of the day, what we're now learning, my favorite focus as a research issue is body composition, which I've written about. And at the end of the day, enough with this stepping on the scale and that's all you see. I'd like to look under the hood and have a little look at the quality of a woman's body, not the quantity. So to your point about wanting to be skinny and the rest of it. Also, my colleague at the American College of Sports Medicine, Katie Schmitz, you probably have read her wonderful work on the relationship between exercise and breast cancer. And that is, instead of just sitting there and doing nothing, doing some form of physical activity at the appropriate time during, you know, cancer therapy and post is very, very essential to her healing and her recovery, her appropriate recovery at so many levels. I'm really loving the emergence of this kind of research that shows the continuum of physical fitness throughout a woman's life, all the way through the postmenopausal years, of which there could be 30 to 40 plus if our menopause is roughly around 52. So that's why this muscle chapter really, you know, hit it home for me in pushing the whole issue of strength training throughout life is so terribly important. I think you and I have our challenge, given the fact that this is quite generational, that if we're talking to a 70-year-old woman, this may be a newsflash. But if you're talking to a 30 or 40-year-old, I think it might be more familiar. What do you think?
I think so. I definitely think in my older population, it's very intimidating to think about how can you start strength training. And to your point, it is so important at every age for all women, but especially our cancer patients. You know, historically, the idea is when you're going through cancer treatment, you should relax, you should lie around. And we know that exercise, being fit both before, during, and after treatment redounds to better outcomes, so much so that exercise decreases the risk of recurrence. And for those patients who've never been diagnosed, it's one of our most powerful risk reduction strategies for decreasing the risk not only of breast cancer, but many other diseases. And you are absolutely right about these antiquated ideas of body mass index and the scale simply do not reflect some of the most key biomarkers of women's fitness, and that's really muscle to fat ratio. You can be thin and almost what's called skinny fat, right? Where you've got a greater percentage of fat rather than you do muscle, and that almost sets you up for some of the same risk factors as those who are more significantly overweight. In terms of the younger population, I do think that younger women tend to be a little bit more informed about the power of strength training, but I still see a lot of pressure to look a certain way, to have these tiny, tiny waists and then maybe stronger buttocks and thighs. But some of these beauty ideals are extremely impossible to attain.
And you and I have read so much about many of these elite runners, especially, who have basically been tortured and tormented by coaches who insist upon a specific look, you know, when they're running and back and forth. Figure skating is another ugly one. And in the headlines, we now read about so many of these young athletes who now have eating disorders like you've never seen because they have to be able to get that appearance down, which is absolutely absurd. We're looking at performance, not appearance. And that appearance issue is something I see it as another control issue. For God's sake, if someone is going to break a world record, they're going to get a gold and whatever. Who cares whether or not they have the smallest waist in the room? What does that even mean? I mean, that's just crazy. I just sit back and I say, enough. You know, the other thing that is a big challenge for you and me is that we got to get real here. And that is today, which is 2024, we have to look at the demographics for women. And the demographics are very challenging because the mass majority of women are overweight and a very large percentage, 40% plus, are obese. And by the year 2030, which is only 6 years from now, you know, there's a very good chance that the majority of the adult USA population will be obese. And given that, it just makes it more difficult for us to be able to translate a definition of health and beauty within all of those constraints. And I'm wondering how you see tackling this.
Oh, I think, well, it starts with conversations like this. It starts at a young age and empowering our girls. You know, I have two boys and a little girl to really honor that strength is important, that fitness is important, that rather than fitting in a size 2 jeans, can you lift your backpack safely? Can you carry your groceries safely? And I think it starts with cultural and societal discussions as early as the classroom about what it means to feel healthy and strong and confident in your body.
I think that you're already gifting your children with so much of this because you yourself practice it. You walk the talk. You know, a lot of people write off kids. They go kind of go, well, whatever. No, those kids are watching everything you do. And they're going to want to emulate that, whether they know it or not, in their little young brains. When they see you doing your thing like that, that's awesome. I just learned something really fascinating. With the American College of Sports Medicine, I'm on a youth fitness task force. I just learned something interesting. Because of the COVID lockdowns and all the rest of it, our children now are weaker and slower than prior generations. And it breaks my heart. The other piece to this is really fascinating. And that is by the age of 7, not 17, you know, we used to think that the big time in life to watch in terms of predicting for adult behavior is actually your adolescent years. It's wrong. When it comes to fitness, by the age of 7, whatever your physical activity level is then will predict your adult activity. I sat with that for a minute, and I was trying to remember, you know, went back on a few little pictures there in my youth and the rest of it, called my siblings, and sure to form, by the age of 7, I was hanging out of trees, falling in mud holes, terrorizing the neighborhood with my brothers on our bikes. And I was pretty physically active, which pretty much is a good predictor for what happened to me decades later. You, Elizabeth, are a phenomenal model and excellent role model for your children and for others when they see you practicing what you preach. And I'm sure you share that with your patients. Just this morning, I got up and I had the best walk with my dog. We went out for 3 miles, and wow, what a great way to start the day. You know, just sharing so that it normalizes physical activity, especially among people who have been more hesitant to do that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I also think it's about one of the things that's so beautiful about children and activity in our youth is that it's seen as play. And so much of fitness that we categorize today is like, oh my God, I got to go to the gym, or oh my God, I got to get on the treadmill. Why and where did we lose the joy of playing into adulthood? And so one of the ways that I try to tap into with patients to think about exercise is think about how you played as a kid. Did you like dancing, right? You don't have to go to the gym. Maybe you go take a dance class, which is something I love to do. How did you like to sweat and move around? Tapping into what really brings joy and that there is joy in movement without intimidating everybody that it has to look like lifting weights at the gym all the time.
We don't stop playing because we grow old. We grow old because we stop playing. My favorite quote from George Bernard Shaw. And when you said the word play, I mean, that's exactly what came to mind. Instead of turning everything into a torture chamber experience of sweating and grinding your teeth and all the rest of it, for God's sake, you know. But women as mothers, women as professionals, we are role models for all of this. And the muscle piece of this, I think, is so terribly important so that we give up this crazy belief that was inculcated years and decades ago that we should be kind of delicate little things. Joan Benoit Samuelson is another good friend of mine. Of course, she won the first marathon at the Olympics, and she's a smaller person, you know, a little shorter and slight, as so many of the marathoners are, but she just goes out there and crushes it. And she was told countless times, are you sure you can handle this? You know, are you sure you're going to be, she's like, what are you talking about? Like, get out of my way already. And of course she won the Olympic marathon. And I think of that all the time when people think of us as delicate little flowers. I think I was really blessed in many respects because I was built to be a strength-trained athlete. I've done powerlifting, I've done other stuff, just because of the way my genetics are. So I remember being a bit self-conscious about my muscles when I was in the San Francisco Ballet Academy because I didn't have the super lean look. I was just very muscular. And I kept thinking, is something wrong with me? Because nobody was giving me affirmations about that. I mean, I could clearly do all the steps and back and forth, but I wondered about that constantly. I doubted myself until later on in life when it became quite clear that I was very happy that happened on the overall. So muscle, huh? Women can move in dignity and grace, in airy lightness or conscious strength, bodies erect and firm, energetic and active, bodies that are truly sovereign in their presence, the expressions of a sovereign nature. And this was Elizabeth Blackwell, our first female U.S. recipient of a medical degree. You know, I read that and I had again pause. I thought that was beautiful. Thank you for including that in the book.
Yeah. Well, it's ever true today, right? We can move in dignity and grace and lightness and conscious strength and bodies erect with confidence, right? Which is what so many of us have not had the opportunity to do. Even the way that our posture is scrutinized. You know, there are a lot of girls that growing up don't feel like they can stand up straight because they're trying to hide their breast development because they're embarrassed by it or don't want to be gawked at. What are the ways that society and male gaze influences how women feel that they can not just work out, but how they can walk down the street?
Yeah, I think out of the muscle chapter, what you get is, yes, we're very strong. Yes, we need to empower ourselves with that throughout our entire lives and never make an apology for it for 1 second. And that's the way it goes. As you go through from chapter to chapter, I just am once again floored by the history. You know, it's sort of an interesting thing. You know, if you don't know history, you're condemned to repeat it. And sometimes I wonder, as we look at all this today, how much of this is really sticking? How much of the lessons to be learned are truly sticking? What do you think about that?
I think the stickiness depends on how receptive we are to it. We're doing this podcast today. One of the beautiful things in writing this book was realizing outside of the cancer world just how many women and men care about women's health and improving the lives of women. So I am optimistic. There's also a tremendous movement in government right now in the private sector to invest in women's health research because we know we need that investment in order to move the clinical needle and to develop meaningful new treatments and diagnostic tools for women. The White House Women's Research Institute just announced $100 million of funding. President Biden discussed $12 billion over time investing in women's health. So I am optimistic because if we put our money where our mouth is, we're not just in an empty echo chamber.
Did you ever get angry when you were writing this?
Hell yeah.
So that's hell to the yes.
Yeah. So that's one of the things. I have spent my life very much being that good girl. I've got a resume that reflects that. I have a personality that is accommodating. And I devoted my life to caring for patients in a very giving way. And I became a female physician, which is a hard road to navigate. I think it is many professional roads are hard to navigate as women. But the more I read, you asked me, why did I write this book? Because at some point it became so damn enraged. I can't hear another woman apologize for sweating or because she didn't shave her legs. Do I have to shave mine before I come see you in the hospital? So at some point for me, I did become enraged. And it's only, I think, since writing the book that I've been able to say, yes, you know, I was motivated to do it for the following reasons, but also because I was really freaking angry that women were continually mistreated.
Yep. I hear that throughout the entire book, that there's, again, another undercurrent as I'm unpacking the layers here that are associated with the book. There's an undercurrent of, are you flipping kidding me? Did this really happen? Is this continuing to happen, you know, one way or the other? It's crazy. Well, I'm looking at your breath chapter. Perhaps women breathe different air. Where did that come from?
Well, just really, when I sought out to write this chapter, I said, well, what don't I know? I think the thing that really enraged me was this idea of going back to tuberculosis, which we called consumption, and that there was somehow beauty in women being breathless and dying that was romanticized in the literature as this version of heroin chic, this woman so pale, so beautiful, so breathless. And then talking to current experts in pulmonary fields of how we really just don't fully address certain pulmonary issues in women. But what really enraged me and disappointed me in terms of my own awareness was learning just how much women suffer domestic abuse at the hands of an intimate partner. One out of every four women suffers some form of severe violence at the hands of an intimate partner in the United States. I was not aware of that number. I don't know about you and your training, but I was taught, you know, we say, oh, do you feel safe at home and kind of leave it at that. And in speaking with emergency room colleagues, the number of women that have undiagnosed or present with diagnosable issues related to being strangulated in the setting of domestic violence, that is sometimes missed in the emergency room. And that is too often a gateway maneuver into murder. And it's terrifying to me to think about how many women are first seen in an emergency room when they've actually been hit in the head multiple times, had many broken bones. I think this is an epidemic in this country, and that leaves me breathless.
You're absolutely correct. And it brings to mind when I was in my training, and I think I was an intern in the ER at the time. I was doing my ER rotation. I'm an internist. And a beautiful woman came in, and what I saw were belt buckle, basically marks all over her body. And it was really awful looking. And she was in great pain. And I obviously asked her what happened. And, oh, my husband just got a little angry. And she minimized it. And I begged her. I said, I could get you into a shelter. Can I call a social worker this minute? I've got all kinds of resources. I can do this. Can you please let me help you? She was like on the fence and back and forth. And then I had a couple of other patients to see. I came back. The room was empty. She had left. It was interesting because 10 days later, she came in as a dead on arrival. Yeah, and it was the same thing all over again, except this time she was strangled to death after she was savagely beaten. The good news is he was behind bars. I mean, I was all over that one. But I sat there with it. I remember grieving deeply in our little prep room in the ER. I sat there alone, and I said, I'm never allowing that stuff. I'm just going to be very, very in everyone's face when a woman comes in and that kind of thing is going on, because I know where it's going to end. I have no tolerance for that. It gave me a tremendous amount of power to be able to open my mouth and not even be, you know, the slightest bit shy about bringing this to the fore. So I became quite famous for calling the police. I just can't deal with it. If they don't have the wherewithal, then I have to. And I've gotten in the face of more men than you've ever seen. To this day, this continues at a very high rate. And you know, it's not just physical violence. It's emotional. It's verbal. So this is abuse, abandonment, neglect. All of these things also count toward what women are going through these days. And to be able to have a woman wake up from a lot of this and say, I'm going to use whatever resources I can, I'm out of here, is so terribly, terribly important. Don't you think?
Yeah, I'm just still sitting with that story. I think, you know, you're a wonderful advocate, and also we need far more of that in our society.
Yeah, it's just, who's been there for women, you know, on the overall? The good news is, I think that Gen Z, as they're coming through, and the millennials, I think, might be more empowered. I don't know. Am I overreading that?
I'd like to think so. I'd like to think so. I hope you're right.
I know. I'm just sort of trying desperately to make sure all of this happens. So as we're kind of wrapping this up, gift all of my wonderful Her podcast audience some jewels that they could take home and go, wow, from your book, because you have so many here. Why don't you select from some of these amazing diamonds and rubies and sapphires here?
Well, let me start with the idea that in writing this book, I had two choices in the literary market. Was I going to write a prescriptive book, like 10 steps to wellness type thing, or something that really described in magnitude a big problem? And for me, I wanted to start with a big idea of how we could move the needle towards more equitable health for women. So the first step in that for me, and what I hope women will gain from reading this book, is that whether it's a woman in ancient Greece or the 17th century or in my office, you may recognize pieces of yourself in her story. Whether it's a story of shame, whether it's a story of embarrassment, being misunderstood, or a diagnosis that takes way too long to get to. And I truly believe that the way we experience our bodies is through stories, the stories we've inherited and the stories we tell ourselves. If after reading this book, my hope, my sincere hope, is that women might be able to tell a new story about themselves, one that is more empowered, so that when that voice is talking to themselves about who they are and the kind of care they deserve. It is one that advocates for themselves in a more deserving playing field. For action items, I think that when women go to the doctor, particularly with a new diagnosis, it's essential that you bring somebody with you. Because I don't care how smart you are or how great of an advocate you are, when you're in pain, when you're anxious, you need somebody else there to help hear you and advocate for you. Second, I also think that it's very important that people be aware of who is on their care team so that they know who's going to be communicating with them. It may not just be a doctor. It could also be a nurse and a nurse practitioner. And lastly, if you don't like your doctor or think that they don't like you, you got to find a new doctor. This isn't the type of thing that you have to tough it out. Women need to feel heard. They need to feel listened to. And that's incredibly important in the doctor-patient relationship. And if you feel moved by these endeavors, there's lots of ways to get involved in women's health research and advocating for women's health and philanthropic causes as well. And I encourage women to and men to recognize that we're all in this together. And the healthier our women are in society, the healthier our overall society is.
I just love this. What beautiful words. And speaking of words, here are yours. I believe in a future where in those terrible moments when a patient is adrift on an ocean of pain, fear, and uncertainty, I will take her hand and neither of us will apologize. Not for sweating, not for crying, not for anything. There is nothing to be sorry for. What a great way to end this book.
Thank you.
Very, very beautiful. You know, Elizabeth, I can't thank you enough. This has just been a fabulous interview. I think all of our listeners are saying, I got to run get this. I got to understand. And remember, for all of you out there, there's going to be at least one chapter that absolutely nails it for you that you might want to really hone in on as you read All in Her Head by Dr. Elizabeth Comen. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being on the Her podcast.
Thank you so much for having me and for all your advocacy.
Oh, yeah. And let's both keep up our own walk in the talk and mentoring and getting the message out there. And this book is a beautiful way to do this. All right. Now, for everyone out there, run on over to iTunes right now to rate and review this terrific episode because we're waiting for your feedback. And here's another shout out to our sponsor, Solaray Vitamins, vitamins, minerals, and herbs rooted in nature. Make sure to ask about the Her Life Stages over at your local health food store. Check it out at solaray.com using promo code HER20 for 20% off. Look, this has been another amazing Her podcast. Oh, I get such a joy out of these kinds of interviews. I'm Dr. Pam Peek, your host, and I want to thank each and every one of you for listening in and being such an important part of our Her podcast community. Pop on over to drpeek.com to learn more about my work and social media. Join me every single week for another Her podcast, where you're going to hear from extraordinary, entertaining, and engaging thought leaders, just like Dr. Elizabeth Comen, as we share our wit and wisdom for you to enjoy. Thanks so much, and remember that your time in this world may be limited, but the things you can do with that time are not. So get on out there, seize the day. Have a great one.